Good afternoon. My name is Brian Ovechelsky, Associate Editor with Drug Topics and Total Pharmacy. Today, I'm here with Mark Cougar, a litigation attorney with over 40 years of experience. How are you today, Mark?
I'm good, thank you. Good to be here.
Awesome. So before we get into pharmacy benefit managers today and your experience defending independent pharmacies, would you like to give our audience a little bit of background on yourself?
Yeah, I've been a lawyer for more years than I care to admit. I spent about a lot of my experience was doing environmental litigation against major polluters on behalf of victims of chemical contamination. And about 10 years ago, I was contacted by some pharmacists in the Philadelphia area about bringing a case against PBMs on behalf of independent pharmacies. That time, I did not know what a PBM was or is. And when I investigated the industry, I was pretty shocked at what I found. A little more about my background. I grew up living upstairs from a mom and pop convenience store. So I know what it's like to run an independent small business. My dad was not a wealthy man, but one thing he was able to do in his business was he set the price of everything he sold. Seems like a pretty self-evident proposition. You're selling something, you know what your overhead is, you know what you paid for the item, you know what you want to sell it for. People can buy it or not buy it, but you know what you're going to sell it for. And I was utterly stunned to see that pharmacists don't work that way. That when pharmacists deal with an insurance company, which is, you know, 99, 95% of what they do, the insurance company tells them what they're going to sell it for. Except it's not really the insurance company, we know it's the PBM. So that was stunning. And the other stunning thing was that there really are not contracts in this business in the way you would normally think of a contract. You know, in law school, we're taught what a contract is. A contract is a meeting of the minds between two parties, let's say a buyer and a seller, right? Your prototypical contract might be when you buy a house or even a car. You know, you negotiate a price and you sign papers. And here, nobody had signed a contract. I mean, virtually no pharmacy had a contract with any PBM. The PSAOs signed contracts. They were secret. The pharmacies couldn't even see them. And I'm now looking at a close to $1 trillion a year business, certainly hundreds of billions of dollars a year, which is standing on a foundation of contractual quicksand. So what I found was really pretty mind-boggling. And then as I got deeper into it, I then learned about all the corruption in the PBM industry. And so we started bringing lawsuits.
What is the evolution of them since you learned about them, like up until now?
They become much more vertically integrated since then. You know, Express Scripts and Cigna merged, Catamaran merged into Optum and United Health. So Catamaran, I don't think, when I sued Catamaran originally, was integrated with any commercial health insurance companies. Now they're integrated with the biggest commercial health insurance company. So there's been a lot of vertical integration. And I don't have data at my fingertips to substantiate this, but I basically believe that the mail order pharmacies owned by the PBMs have gotten bigger and bigger. And that's part of the vertical integration, that they have become increasingly aggressive in trying to steer customers away from retail pharmacies to their mail order. Basically, they've just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. And unfortunately, there's been some significant attrition among independent pharmacies. Particularly, it seems like this year has been particularly bad, which was not surprising. So I don't know what the total number is in the country, but I believe it's gone down probably at least 10% since I've become involved.
Gotcha. So do you think that I feel like there's been a lot of recent news about PBMs and kind of the government reform, and that news is getting to a lot more eyes than once was happening recently.
Correct.
as far as like FTC investigations and stuff like that. Do you think that we're kind of at a place where the tides could change in the near future?
They should, and they could, and they should. I mean, I think everybody, the latest I heard was we thought Congress was heading towards a solid bipartisan bill, but then I heard that everything's pushed back to the end of the year. But, it should happen. I think the politicians, the legislature are now aware of it. I really am cautiously optimistic about the FTC because they don't get hung up in the kind of partisan infighting that happens in Congress. Even though, like I said, there's a solid bipartisan support for this, not only in the US Congress, but pretty much every state legislature. For instance, Wisconsin, which is pretty notorious as a very divided purple state, where I think it passed the Wisconsin legislature 101 to nothing or 99 to one or something like that. And that's not unusual. But it just has to happen. And it's very difficult because to do it on a state level, because the PBMs will maintain, rightly or wrongly, that any state regulation is preempted by ERISA, even though they lost that in the US Supreme Court with regard to Arkansas 9-0. That's not going to stop them. They're multi-gazillion dollar companies. They have armies of lawyers. They can outstaff any state attorney general's office if they decide to fight it. And so
Yeah, it's pretty,
that's what they'll do.
pretty incredible that they're able to do that. Just hopefully that more and more eyes can get on it, and so something can be done. People can actually move legislation down to the finish line eventually.
Yes, exactly. I mean, there are some really powerful state laws out there, as you're probably aware, like Arkansas's. But what's happened, what I've heard, is that the state AGs or the state insurance departments have not been aggressive in enforcing them. So they're just laws on the books, but pretty much business continues.
So diving a little more into like the actual practices of PBMs and kind of how they're taking away from smaller pharmacies, could you just explain some of their key tactics and the things that you've run into? Basically, what exactly are these PBMs doing to these community pharmacies?
Well, first thing, underpay. I could never top Mark Cuban's 2-minute summary of quote shitting on independent pharmacies. Like, there's a reason he's a celebrity and I'm not, right? Besides the fact he has billions of dollars. But underpaying them, paying them below cost, is one thing. The clawbacks and DIR fees are just horrendous in terms of just companies can't plan. There's no transparency whatsoever. They're opaque. They're obscure in terms of the criteria they use. The criteria is unfair, beyond the control of independent pharmacies. There is severe price discrimination. They pay much higher prices to large chains than independents. I think there's claims where they will bill the plan on a brand rate and pay the pharmacy at a generic rate and make gigantic markups as a result of that. And they, like I said, they steer and steal patients toward their mail order pharmacy. So it's pretty clear their agenda. I think they want to grab every single prescription dollar they can. And if they could put everybody into mail order, that's what they would do. And they want to grab every single penny. Say two things about PBMs. They need secrecy, like you and I need oxygen to breathe. Everything is hidden from everybody. We don't know what the plan's paying them. The plans don't know what they're paying us. There's tremendous lack of transparency on rebates. The other thing I'll say is, if there were a Nobel Prize for greed, they would win it, because they have figured out every single way to skim money out of this system. With the result that, and that is obviously one of the reasons why drug prices in the United States are so high. Not the only reason. Pharma is, they're not angels either. They have not delivered, and they don't have the incentive to deliver low cost drugs at a low price to the patient.
Very well put as far as the Nobel Peace Prize and greed. I definitely see it.
Nobel Greed Prize.
That's a better
If
way
there
to
were
put it.
Nobel Prize for greed, they would win it, you know. They have a lot of competition, but they'd win it.
As far as how these PBMs are able to do all of this, would you say there's another kind of like you have the independent pharmacies, you have the PBMs. Do you think there's like a third party that's kind of assisting them as far as do you think it's drug manufacturers more so or the insurance companies or kind of a collection of them just working together to put the small guys out of business?
Well, you know, it seems, you know, it seems there's a fair amount of animosity between pharma, the drug manufacturers, and PBMs. I mean, I don't know enough to really comment on that. Obviously, they're paying them a lot of rebates. They certainly have testified in Congress. They've passed, you know, they pointed a finger at the PBMs as the reason for the high price of drugs. In terms of the insurance companies, I do have some concerns, but I can't really prove anything about whether there's backroom deal sharing going on between the commercial insurance companies and PBMs. Of course, they're integrated. A lot of times the same company. There is, I think, a role being played by brokers here. And again, I don't have a lot of facts at my fingertips, but there's data out there showing the brokerage commissions when they place an account with these PBM, let's say a large self-insured employer, maybe 5,000 employees. The brokerage commissions are, I've heard anecdotes, they're just absolutely astonishing. They get a piece of every prescription. It's nuts. I don't know if you've heard about that, but
Not
it's
too much about
really.
the brokerage, more so just the kind of like the PBMs were like working with the drug manufacturer as far as formulary.
No, it's there's a podcast called Relentless Health Value, run by a brilliant lady named Stacey Richter. Very plain spoken, but absolutely brilliant. And if you go on there, she has a couple of interviews with people knowledgeable about brokers, and well worth listening to.
For sure,
They
definitely
my
check.
ears popped out, you know. It was the commission. It was like t they were astonishing. 20% of the
Wow.
book of business were. It was as the numbers, as I recall, were absolutely astonishing. And that's really a below the radar thing, you know. And you know, the part of that discussion was these brokers. Okay, so you're an employer. Look, you're making widgets, right? I'm not in the health. I'm in the widget business. I don't. What do I know from health insurance? But I gotta have make sure my employees are insured, right? So who's gonna find me the best plan? Well, I'm gonna go to John Doe broker. He's reputable. He'll find me the best plan. Obviously, the broker's incentive is not to put me in a cheap plan. The broker is being paid by the PBM, not by me, and winds up putting me in a, yeah. And this is why we had a. I have a lot of expertise in the area of mortgage fraud, and bank fraud, and predatory lending. That was another one of my areas, and I was heavily involved in litigation over the 2008 bank crash. And that was largely caused by the fact that mortgage brokers were incentivized to put people in high interest loans where they were likely to default. I mean, that was a gigantic portion of what happened. I don't know how many people knew about it. I read 14 books about the mortgage fraud. You know, this is to say it's a problem is an understatement. This apparently is going on with PBMs also.
And it's you can really just put it all in one basket and say that it's money and it's money they're trying
Yeah,
to.
it's money not being used for patient care. You know, it look, you know, if a, you know, we all if, you look, if some drug company puts $1 zillion in a research in and comes up with a wonderful drug for horrible disease like rheumatoid arthritis, God bless them. You know, but for 30, 20% of that to go to a broker, what the F?
So, with all the power that PBMs seem to wield, is government reform really the only option to kind of take that power away? Are there other things? And I'm also going to ask you about a little bit more about your experience litigating with these smaller pharmacies.
Well, I'm gonna refer you to two people. One's Benjamin Jolly, who I assume you've heard of. If not, you should reach out to him. And of course, Mark Cuban. They both are advocating various methods of private sector reform. I think the main thing, which both of them talk about, is the self, and Stacy Richter talks about this at great length. These employers running these plans have to educate themselves so they're not getting screwed. They just have to educate. Cuban talks about it. Cuban was on Stacy's podcast. Stacy talks about it, and I know Ben has a model he talks about, which I really can't repeat. I don't recall the details of another way around it where we won't have to rely on government. Because the problem with relying on the government, aside from the obvious, is that we're playing whack-a-mole, and if they divine one regulatory scheme, these Nobel Prize-winning greed people will come up with another way around it. The FTC would be much more nimble at dealing with that than any Congress would, because then, but Congress, you're going to pass another law 2 years later. The FTC can monitor this stuff and stay more on top of it. But so they've advocated those things. Everything they say makes a lot of sense. And you know, but you know, these employers really, really need to look into this, and it takes time. But it's worth their time because, you know, they can save a ton of money if they just don't trust your broker and don't trust the BPM and do some due diligence, and you'll save a lot of money.
Yeah, so it's the PBMs have the power and it's theirs to give away. It's not anyone else's to take, it seems like, as
We
far as like.
have to take it. No, you have to take it. It can be taken if the employers, you know, do their due diligence and bone up and see what's really going on. They can take it back. No one, at the end of the day, no one can force them to sign a contract.
Gotcha.
But they need, you know, it's, you know, these transparency laws should help in that. You know, so they don't have, you know, it's laid out for them, so they don't have to penetrate an impenetrable pile of data.
Could you just talk about your successes or just overall experience,
So we've litigated against
representing?
Optum, and Optum's business model, and this is also true of Caremark and to a lesser extent Express Scripts. So listen, they're not stupid, right? If they're going to cheat people, which they do, let's do it in such a way that we can't get caught. So we don't want people to be able to take us to court. So we're going to have an arbitration clause. Okay, arbitration clause. All right, you know, I've been in arbitrations for myself. You know, there can be advantages. You don't get hung up in court delays. In theory, it could be much more efficient than a jury trial, you know, and things like that. But they stack the deck of the arbitration clause so as to make it impossible for you to vindicate your rights. What Optum did when I first got involved, they've changed their clause about three or four times as a result of me arguing to courts that it's unconscionable and unenforceable. And we've won on that several times. First of all, every single pharmacy has to separately litigate, whether it's still their provision. So let me take an absurd example. I have clients, the same guy, same or the same, maybe two partners own five different pharmacies. Each of them are separate LLCs, which is perfectly legal. You know, they'd have to file five separate arbitrations before separate. So right there, you're talking $5,000 each just for the filing fees. In our filing an arbitration is much more expensive than filing in court. Court filing fees $400. AAA arbitrations at least $5,000. Then they had separate panels of three arbitrators for each case. Three arbitrators, each of whom must have 10 years health law experience, all in the agreement. So it will cost you at least $125,000 to have your case tried,
Wow.
just for the arbitrator's fees, not counting the attorney, not counting the expert witnesses, not counting the usual cost of litigation. They're going to layer on another 125 grand. So it's a, so basically you can't do it. It's if you have a $5 million claim, you can do it. If you have a $150,000, $200,000 claim, you can't do it.
And on the
It's
other
just
side, it's
not.
just they have all the money and they.
Right. Yeah, and they have $75 billion. They don't care. So they built in the business model a stacked deck that you can't win. And most of my time has been spent fighting that. But I'll tell you one thing that happened. When we started, I said, okay, I'll arbitrate. I had 28 pharmacies. We filed an arbitration. That particular arbitration clause said nothing about you couldn't consolidate multiple pharmacies in one case. It was completely silent. They file a motion with the arbitrator. We want you to split this into 28 different arbitrations. The arbitrator, much to my chagrin, agrees with them. Okay, this is going to be split into 28 separate arbitrations. Okay, now I'm looking at the situation. I got 28 arbitrators. I still have one arbitrator. We can handle this. Let's try one case. Let's see how that one arbitrator decides that case. And let's see whether we can agree that I'll agree if you'll agree that the arbitrator who tries it can apply those decisions to everybody else, so that we can still have some efficiency here. And you know what their response to that was? Take
That
a guess. We want 28 separate arbitrators.
for no reason.
There was a reason to bust balls. The reason was to make it impossible for us to litigate.
Wow.
We want 20, so that nothing we did in front of that arbitrator number one would have any binding effect in front of arbitrator number two. Nothing arbitrator two did would have any binding effect on arbitrator number three. So basically it could just string us out forever.
When they're essentially all the same cases.
It was all the same case. When you investigate the way they work, they basically, in terms of MAC pricing, which is a lot of what my cases are about on generic drugs, they have the same MAC pricing system for every health plan. They may apply it differently, but it's all one contract. The provider manual says, here's how we set MAC prices. They have the same MAC price team work. They have the same criteria. So there's no meaningful differences. It's basically doing a calculation as to what did they pay you compared to what do the wholesale benchmarks require? So, there was no reason for that other than to make the litigation as cumbersome, inefficient, and expensive as possible to deter us from trying to vindicate their rights. None of which is a proper use of arbitration. But they don't want to, they don't enter. Arbitration is supposed to be a means of facilitating dispute resolution. They use it to frustrate dispute resolution.
Yeah, it's almost like so they have all the things that they do toward pharmacists as far as spread pricing, no transparency, all those things, and then they have kind of a whole other batch of tricks that they can do within the court and to kind of drag that along
Yeah,
and.
exactly. So, I mean, the two are inextricably linked. You're not going to cheat people unless you find a way not to get caught. So one way they'll get is lack of transparency. The other way is anytime anybody sues us, we're going to force them into arbitration, make it as expensive as possible, drag it out for years until they eventually go away.
Which is very not surprising.
Right.
All right. Well, that is all I have for you. I really
Okay.
appreciate you taking the time today. I thought it was a great conversation. I will let you go.
Okay,
I
thanks.
really appreciate it.
Sure.